the last narrative chapter of Daniel, and when I say narrative chapter, that's because the rest of the chapters after tonight's are weird. So we'll be looking at those beginning in chapter 7 next week. The last narrative chapter of Daniel is almost certainly the most famous. How many times do you think you've heard the story of Daniel in your lifetime? Just think about it, including Bible classes and VBSs and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For those of you who grew up in the church, that answer is going to be way different than those who were converted later. Daniel is one of those stories that tends to be a children's story, right? We teach this to our kids. And it's memorable. It sticks out. So how many times do you think you've heard that? A dozen, maybe? Two dozen times? I don't know. If you've been a Christian for 40 years, you may have heard this story a lot. And that's an interesting tension in my job because most of my content's just not going to be new for a lot of you. Now, for some of you it is, hopefully, as we're evangelizing and converting, of course, and that makes my job easier because I can do some stuff that people haven't heard before. But for a lot of you, most of my content is not going to be new. And I think Peter understood this. Peter has two verses that are really inspiring to me personally as a preacher, because Peter knew by the time that Peter's writing 1st and 2nd Peter, which is later on in the history of the church in the first century, that a lot of this stuff was going to be repetition and reminding. 2 Peter 1, 12 through 15. Therefore, I intend always to remind you of these qualities, though you know them and are established in the truth you have, which many of you do. You know them and you've been established in the truth. I think it right, as long as I am in this body, to stir you up by way of reminder, since I know that the putting off of my body will be soon, as our Lord Jesus Christ made clear to me. He's talking about he's going to die. And I will make every effort so that after my departure, after I die, you may be able at any time to recall these things. That's kind of my job, is to make sure that you guys know these things, even though you already do know them, to stir you up by way of reminder, right? 2 Peter 3, 1 and 2, I am stirring up your sincere mind by way of reminder that you should remember the predictions of the holy prophets and the commandment of our Lord and Savior through your apostles. And he goes on and on and on. So even though you've read, I don't know if you've read it a bunch, but even though you've heard the story of Daniel chapter 6, which is Daniel in the lion's den, right? And Daniel chapter 6 is where we are. The story of Daniel in the lion's den, even though you've heard that a bunch, hopefully, as we go through this text and as we're reminding each other, as we're going through the text and reminding each other of the truths that are in them, this idea of stirring you up, that you may have heard this before, but stirring you up, the when you think about like a liquid that has stuff in it, like this, hot chocolate. If you buy cheap hot chocolate, what happens? Well, it all settles down to the bottom, right? And then you get the dregs of it at the end, and it's super chocolatey, and you wasted all that beverage. It was just basically hot water up until the last bit. Well, that's what's happening here. He's stirring up the hot chocolate so that it'll be good hot chocolate all the time, because that's what you have to do with the hot chocolate. That's what this stirring up is, that we're taking the things that have maybe fallen to the recesses of our mind, and we're stirring them up into our lives once again. Why do some stories stick out so much? Because I think Daniel in the Lion's Den is a story that sticks out quite a bit. One, it's miraculous. I think that tends to make things stick out in our minds. It's easy for kids to understand some of the significance. Not all of it, because we're going to talk about tonight. Daniel 6 is deep, guys. It's really deep. And there's a lot of allegory behind Daniel 6 that as a kid you're not going to get. But as it is with most awesome kids' movies, the kids get it a little bit. They get some of the significance, but there's so much more for the adults, right? There's such another level for the adults. So I think it sticks out for kids because, hey, it's lions, and he stopped up the mouths of the lions, and Daniel didn't die, but then the other guys, they got eaten, right? That's kind of cool for a kid. We get that. And there's an easy lesson or moral to the story in Daniel 6. There's a surface level, easy lesson that is easy for anyone of any age to understand. That God has your back. Kids get that. Adults get that. Everyone gets that. God's got your back, and he will do amazing things for you. But as we go through this, more than anything, I think, for a story with supernatural elements, because there's a lot of stories with supernatural elements that I can't relate to in my own personal life. Like Paul is with the proconsul, and this guy is in the proconsul's ear and distracting him, and Paul's just like, boom, you're blind now. Well, I can't relate to that in my life. There's nothing I can do even close to that. But the story of Daniel, it has supernatural elements, but something very similar could happen to anyone, that there would be persecution and false accusations, and then they would be brought before some sort of authority, and God would get them out of it. That is something that could very easily happen in my life, something that very easily could happen in your life. So I think one of the reasons Daniel 6 stands out to us, the story of Daniel in the lion's den, why it stays in our brain, is because this is something that could happen to you, that you would be falsely accused and vindicated at the end, even though you'd been falsely accused by these people. That's something that very easily could happen to us. So let's go through the story in Daniel chapter 6. We begin with Daniel's elevation. So remember at the end of chapter 5, Belshazzar was ousted and murdered as king. The Medo-Persians came in. It's the super silent coup. Basically overnight, you went to bed as a member of the Babylonian Empire. You woke up as a member of the Medo-Persian Empire, and you had no idea until the next day when they probably sent out couriers and announcers and messengers saying, you have a new king now. And that was it. That was basically it. There was no military presence. There was no bloody battle. There was no civilian casualties. They just went into the palace, murdered and assassinated the leadership, and now you're part of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so it's interesting, Daniel's elevation in Daniel 6, 1 through 3, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, over them three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Why was Daniel put in charge? How did Darius know Daniel? Well, because of the nature of the coup, right? They assassinate the leadership, but there's still a ton of people in the palace that know who Daniel is, that know what Daniel's done. And so when King Darius comes in, he's trying to make this as bloodless as possible, as painless as possible for the civilian population. So he probably asks around, hey, who is a good guy that people know about, that people respect, that I could put in charge of some things? And so Darius comes in, and Daniel's one of those people, because by this point, Daniel's probably pretty well known in the kingdom. He's done a lot of great things. He's been given a lot of responsibility and a lot of power. And so when Darius comes in as the next king, yeah, let's put Daniel in charge, because Daniel has demonstrated over the course of his life that he's a reliable sort. And it's interesting what he says here. Why were the satraps put into account? Why should they have somebody to report to? Because Darius understood that people are corrupt. I need someone who's honest, who will take care of my kingdom, who will not take from my coffers, who will not accept bribes. And so, hey, here's Daniel. Let's put Daniel in charge. And Daniel, of course, proves to be faithful, right, in 4 and 5. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. Why would they want to find fault? Because he's preventing them from being corrupt. He's preventing them from taking money from the king, kind of taking something off the side. Or off the top? Is it off the top? I think it's off the top. This bolded part is, I think, in my opinion, the most profound verse in the book of Daniel. This is the thing that blows my mind most about Daniel. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. If you want a model of righteousness in the midst of sinful people, this is it. Because he has behaved in such a blameless manner and has obviously been so faithful to God that even everybody who hates him knows Daniel is God's man. Daniel, he belongs to God more than anyone else, more than Darius, more than the king. He's not corrupt. He is so blameless and so righteous that even his enemies recognize we're not going to have any rule or any way of accusing him unless we find a way to make it about Jehovah. Unless we find a way to make it about his faith, make it about his religion, make it about his relationship with his God, there's nothing we can do to accuse him. This is the model of righteousness in the midst of a sinful world. To be so blameless that your enemies cannot find any fault with you and they have to attack your faith. They have to attack your relationship with God. So the plot, 6 and 9. O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius, sign the document and injunction. What document? Well, we know, of course, the story, right? That they come to the king and say, how about for 30 days, people can only pray to you. For 30 days, O king, King Darius, if anybody prays to anything and anyone other than you, it will be illegal and punishable by death. And it's interesting, the law of the Medes and the Persians, this is a very important point to make in the story of Daniel, because it comes up over and over again. The whole plan of the satraps, which is to get Daniel in trouble because they know he's going to pray to God, the whole plan hinges on this particular quirk of Medo-Persian law. In verse 8, so that it cannot be changed, which cannot be revoked. Verse 12, the thing stands fast, which cannot be revoked. Verse 15, no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. Verse 17, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. And there's a particular law, apparently, in Medo-Persian law, that if the king signed a particular injunction, the word injunction is the qualifier or the specific word there, that if the king signs this injunction, it cannot be revoked. That if the king wants to remain a faithful steward of the laws of the land, he must abide by this injunction for the period of time. And they said for 30 days. So for 1 month, this law is in effect and nobody can do anything about it. That is the hinge point of the whole story of Daniel in the lion's den. Because if this is not true, if the king can just say, oh, well, that's a stupid law, I'm going to change that law now. You tricked me, but I'm going to take the law away. To do that would be, apparently, and I did some research on this, I don't know, there were several different possible consequences, but possible grounds for their version of impeachment, that you have violated this superseding law to the point that you are no longer fit to be king. That was what was at stake here. So, Daniel's faithfulness in verse 10, Daniel 6:10. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to the house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Several things that are interesting about this verse. He knew that the document had been signed. The text is clear to point that out. The windows were open. The text makes clear to point that out too. And the final thing, as he had done previously. And again, the satraps were not dumb. They were actually pretty clever in their approach to getting rid of Daniel. They observed him, they figured out what the plan needed to be, and they executed it perfectly. They were amazingly clever in their situation, the way they treated Daniel. But the question, why not just shut the windows, man? That's all you had to do, shut the windows. Why not? He knows what the law is. He knows that this is going to get him in trouble. The text makes that abundantly clear. There's a principle behind this, that Daniel was not going to change anything because of his enemies. He wasn't going to change anything he did in his relationship to God, even though it's not a law, right? This wasn't a thing of righteousness. It's not like God had commanded the people, you need to have an open window and you need to pray toward Jerusalem. That was not a commandment. But it was of the mindset that I am not going to change anything about my relationship with God due to an external evil force. Even though it may bite me come around to bite me at the end, even though I may get in trouble for this, I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing. Even though it would be a very simple solution, right? Just reach out and shut the window before you pray. Would have been a simple solution, but Daniel, I think there's a principle behind this that Daniel is so eager about. The trap, 11 through 13. So they set the trap, they accuse him, right? They get him and say, O king, this guy was praying. We saw it because the window was open. He was praying to somebody other than you. And so the king is very distressed in 14 through 18. We're not going to read 14 through 18, but it is interesting how much the king is upset about this. The king, we're going to talk about this at the end. The king is so sad for Daniel. I think a number of reasons. One, Daniel had been faithful. Daniel had been a good person. He had treated Darius right. He had not been corrupt. And Daniel, or the king, Darius, that is, knew that Daniel did not deserve the punishment. And so even though perhaps he didn't want to, he was distressed because he had to. The victory, of course, in 19 through 24, we'll read part of this. After he's thrown in the lion's den, he's going to be eaten, of course. Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king is so sad. He is sorrowful over this thing that has happened. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions. I want to point out again that Daniel's relationship with God was such a fundamental part of his existence that everybody knew it. Everybody knew that this was the guy that worshiped God. It was so fundamental to who he was. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. This is the part of the story I think that we remember the most, right? This is the miraculous thing, that God sent his angel, the mouth, and I don't know, I've thought about this a lot, not a lot, every time I think about the story. What was that like for Daniel overnight? I mean, was he like petting the lions and just hanging out and having a good time? I mean, was he over in one corner and the lions were over in another corner just hanging out? I don't know. It would just be interesting. There's a lot of things in history that I wish I knew how it happened. I wish I knew what had gone on overnight while Daniel was in the pit. Was he doing stuff with the lions, or were they all just kind of sleeping and that was it? I don't know. I just really wish I knew. My God has sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me. Why? Because I was found blameless before him, before God. God knew that this was not something that Daniel deserved. He knew that it was something that was unjust and false, and Daniel had more to do, apparently, in his life, things that needed to be revealed. And so God, of course, saves him from the mouths of the lions. I don't think it's interesting. I think if Daniel had not been faithful in his governorship, if he had been a little corrupt and let the satraps be corrupt, I think that Daniel probably would have gotten eaten. Because Daniel makes it very clear in this text, I have not done anything wrong. If Daniel had done something wrong, I think they throw him in the pit and he gets eaten, and that's the end of it. He was being rewarded very clearly for his blamelessness. Now remember this verse that I bolded and underlined it, because this is going to matter later when we talk about sort of the overall lessons we can learn from the book. So Darius praises God, 25 through 28, which I don't think, no, we're not going to read that. And this is the habit, right? Other than Belshazzar, who doesn't do this. But Nebuchadnezzar and Darius, both times they're confronted with Daniel and his righteousness, they praise God. They recognize that God is amazing, that God is obviously worthy of praise. And it's interesting in the verses here, Darius, what does he say? Has your God, whom you serve continuously. Even though Daniel had apparently been so righteous, the king had not converted. It was his God. And this goes back to the polytheism, right, of the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians and later the Greeks, really most of the rulers throughout history at that time, that you have your God and I have my God. And as long as you're faithful to your God's rules, then your God will bless you. And if I'm faithful to my God's rules, then my God will bless me. But it's interesting that after these things happen, Darius does praise Jehovah as Nebuchadnezzar did before him. Now, we don't have any idea how this eventually worked out for Darius. If he was ever converted, I don't know. I'd like to think so, but probably not. So Darius praises God in 25 through 28, and that's the end. Now, there's so many levels of this story. The rest of the time will be spent on sort of application. Number one, the faithfulness of Daniel. And this is pretty, I think, obvious as you read through the story, the faithfulness of Daniel. And more specifically, a model for our own faithfulness, a model for how we can be faithful in our relationship with God, particularly, and this is the point, Daniel was sort of rare in Israelite history up until this point, because up until this point, Israel has spent a lot of time just surrounded by other people that worship God. They had their nation, they had their capital, they had their town, they had their towns and their land, and all these things had been going on pretty well for a long time. And then, of course, the Babylonians come in, and now we've got 70 years where a generation of Israelites have to live amidst the people that aren't righteous, aren't God's people, that hadn't been done in Israel for a long time. Now, of course, they started out that way in Egypt. We understand that. But Daniel is experiencing an unusual time of Israelite history up until this point where he's having to be faithful when everyone around him is not. And I think that's much more analogous to us than somebody like David. David was faithful, but everybody in Israel was faithful. Well, faithful, quote unquote. Everybody should have believed and should have understood. But Daniel is much more like us in that we live around people that perhaps are not as faithful as we are. Now, note the qualities of his faith then. Number one, he was honest and unselfish in power. He was in charge of stuff. He had prime opportunities to be corrupt and selfish, but he was honest. He was he had integrity. And that, of course, was the thing that kept elevating him. This is the same thing with Joseph, right? The story of Joseph, which is going to be our VBS. That's what happened. Joseph was faithful, and he was honest, and he was a good worker, and he worked hard for his masters, and so they kept elevating him up and up and up. The idea here that being you have opportunities in your life for selfishness and behavior that you may never get caught, right? You have opportunities in your life to be corrupt, and nobody will ever know. Take a little extra money, cheat somebody out of a deal. I don't know, whatever it is you do in your life. Daniel's faithfulness was such that even though he was in a position of extreme power and could have gotten away with a lot of stuff, he did what was right anyway. He was unwilling to change his faith in times of stress and danger. And I don't know, I go back and forth about this, the closing the windows thing. Because I think a lot of us would say that it would be prudent to close the windows. You're not violating any commandments. It's not like your prayers are unrighteous just because your window isn't open now. There was no law or commandment that God had set forth that said you had to pray toward Jerusalem with a window open so you can't even see Jerusalem, right? They're so far away, it doesn't even matter. I think a lot of us would say that closing the windows would be a good idea. And it's just so interesting to me that he doesn't. He knows that this is the thing that's going to get him in trouble. He is unwilling to change his faith because of an external force. Now, there are many times when we change our faith because of internal struggles. We mature and we grow and we reach new understandings of God's will. And so we change the way we live because we've come to a new understanding of the way that God wants us to live. But Daniel was unwilling even to compromise in things that didn't really matter because of an external force, because somebody wanted him to do it. And it's kind of similar to Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, the temptations. I'm not sure that it would have been a sin of itself for Jesus to change the stones in the bread. That wouldn't have been a bad thing because he did that. So he did change fish into bread, or he multiplied fish, right? He multiplied the loaves. It's a very similar sort of expression of God's power. What made the temptation of Jesus a sin, or the thing that would have been a sin, it was simply because the devil wanted him to do it. That was the only thing that made the turning the stones into bread something that would be wrong to do. Not because it would have been an abuse of his power, not because it would have been something that God didn't want him to do, but simply because an enemy wanted him to do it. And I think Daniel here expresses a similar thing. Unwilling to change something that may have been trivial in and of itself, inherently, but because an enemy wanted him to do it, he would not do it. He would remain faithful. And he was so devout that everyone knew, right? The only reason the satrap's plan worked is because he had demonstrated through his life that he was going to be faithful to God no matter what. Everybody knew it. And the question, of course, for us, as we think about the qualities that we're striving for, how like Daniel's is your relationship with God? And this is a personal question, right? I can't really answer this for you. How like your relationship, or how like Daniel's relationship with God is your own? Are you honest and demonstrating integrity, even though you may get away with it? Are you unwilling to compromise or change when your adversaries and persecutors want you to, even though it may not matter, so to speak? Are you so devout that people around you know, hey, that's the guy that is really crazy fundamentalist. That's what we would be called. That's the guy that's really crazy about church. He goes to church like 3 times a week. He's studying his Bible all the time. He keeps talking to me about it. Is that the kind of thing that people know about you? It's just a question. Number two, God's power in distress, right? This is a very clear and present lesson from the story, that God has power over the distress that we have. And this is the first lesson, I think, we learn from the story, even as children, is God's ability to save us in protect those who are faithful to him. That there was a circumstance, a trouble, and God protected Daniel. And I think this is the first thing we learn when we hear it as children. God will protect those who are faithful. And yet, as we mature as Christians, as we mature, our understanding of this principle must mature as well, right? Because it doesn't always work out this way. In our own lives, we may not have nearly the turnaround that Daniel does, or maybe that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do, that we're accused and falsely accused, and then things turn out well, and our enemies get eaten. That's not going to happen for you. Your enemies may not even be punished at all, let alone eaten. They may not have any negative repercussions for their persecution of you. We understand that. And there have been people, many Christians, have been killed because of their faith, right? We know that to be true, even today, that people are killed because of their faith in God. So the lesson, as we're learning through the lesson, and we think about this, as children, it is a good lesson to learn that God protects those who are faithful to him. But as we mature as Christians, we need to understand that this has a deeper spiritual meaning, right? That it's not just that God's going to make all your problems go away, but that God will protect you, if not in this life, then in the life to come, you will be victorious, even if it doesn't work out for you right now. The alternative of that is, it's impossible to reconcile that, of course, with the way things are. The chapter in Hebrews 11, right, or the verses in Hebrews 11, people who very clearly had faith, but they were torn in two, killed by the sword, killed by fire. One of my favorite verses, of whom the world was not worthy. So we know that, of course, God, while he has power to protect those who are faithful, there's a deeper meaning to this lesson, right? It's not just nothing bad is ever going to happen to you as long as you're faithful to God. And the power of this story and that of Daniel's friends in chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I just didn't want to type them out, is Daniel's come what may attitude, right? That's the power of the story. That no matter what happens to me, whatever come what may, I will serve God regardless. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when Nebuchadnezzar's like, why are you not bowing down? What do they say? It's so great. We don't even need to tell you, O king. We're just going to do what we do. That's the attitude that's so powerful in the story of Daniel, and particularly Daniel chapter 6. We're going to end with this. The entire chapter serves as an allegory. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the thing actually happened. It is a literal story. This thing really literally happened. But a thing can be literal and also an allegory at the same time, because there's, I think, some powerful, potent symbolism in Daniel chapter 6 that I had not really ever thought about until I was studying for this lesson. There are some interesting parallels going on. We'll begin with the satraps, those people who are Daniel's sort of enemies in this story. Why did they hate Daniel? Now, the text doesn't tell us specifically. We can infer some things, I think. We can sort of reason through it. Perhaps they were upset that the king clearly favored Daniel over them. Perhaps he was impinging on their ability to be corrupt, right? So they couldn't take as much money as they wanted to, and they couldn't take bribes. I don't know, whatever it was. And we don't exactly know, but I think we can infer some reasons why they hated Daniel. So what did they do? They plotted against him. They accused him before the king, and they figured out a way to make something that was, in their eyes, good, the law, and turn the law into a weapon to use against him. That's what they did. And it's interesting. Consider for a moment how similar they are in both attitude and function to our greatest accuser, the devil. Isn't that kind of what the devil does? He takes a thing that should be good, a thing that stands as justice and something that is reasonable and right, the law of God. He takes the law of God and turns it into a weapon to use against the children of men, the children of God, as we try to do the right thing, but we mess up all the time. And there are several courtroom analogies. Job, of course, is the one that's most prominent, where the devil kind of goes to the king, being God, and says, yeah, he may be great, but X, Y, or Z. That's the idea of the accuser. And really, the word accuser is a word that's used of the devil a lot. And they do what the devil does. They can't find any reason for fault. And so they twist something that the king held dear, the law, and turned it into a weapon to use against Daniel. Now, the king is an interesting stand-in as well. And I said this, we talk about this again. Why is such a big deal made of the king's inability to change the law? Because again, like seven times in the text, right? This is the only reason the story has any tension, is this principle. The only reason the story has any dramatic tension whatsoever is because the king is not allowed to change the law for any number of reasons. We don't exactly know all of them, but we can make some guesses. And it's because of this fact that the king signed into law something that couldn't be changed for 30 days. That's why Daniel is thrown into the lion's den. That's why the king is so upset and so distressed. This is the hinge of their plan. The satrap's plan, if the king can just change the law, the plan is pointless. And it's interesting to me. Did the king want to harm Daniel? Very clearly not. But did the king place the law above Daniel's life? Yeah, he did. The king placed a nebulous concept of the law of the Medo-Persians, because that's what it's called in the text over and over. The king placed that law above the life of Daniel. The law and its unimpeachability, its inability to be changed, the fundamental need to preserve the law, mattered more to Darius than Daniel's life. Consider that this is very probably how God feels about us. He doesn't want to punish us. He doesn't want to condemn us. But there are certain facets of God's personality, certain facets of justice and truth that God is going to prioritize above you. Things that are so fundamental, baked into his nature. Things that sin cannot be tolerated, that I cannot be in the presence, this is from God's perspective, that I cannot be in the presence of sin, that sin is so repulsive and repugnant to him that even though it grieves him to his very core, there's going to be some consequences for our sin. Even though God, we know, because it says, does not wish that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Now, the king was bailed out. Of course, the analogy is not perfect, right? I'm not saying it's a perfect allegory, because there's some differences. The king is bailed out by who? The angel. The angel who comes and stops the lions. Why? Because Daniel was blameless. Daniel, of course, had not done anything wrong. Now, it's interesting. Did Daniel himself do anything to stop the lions? No. If it were just up to Daniel, he'd be eaten by the lions and that'd be the end of the story. But Daniel didn't have the power, and that was okay because somebody else stepped in to do it for him. Did the satraps have any control over the lions? No. If they did, Daniel, of course, would have been eaten. The satraps thought they had such a great plan, such a perfect plan, and in a way it was really perfect and clever. But then this angel comes along, God's angel comes along, stops the mouths of the lions. The satraps can't do anything about it. And then what ends up happening? The lions end up eating the satraps. It's kind of a poetic justice sort of thing. Despite his accusers, and in lieu of grief of the king, a third party steps in to save Daniel from the wrath of the law. And might I suggest that this is exactly what Jesus did. It's not anything that you could have done. It's not anything that I could have done. The law is what it is. And God's justice will be satisfied. And the devil thinks he's got such a great plan that I'm going to twist these little mortals around and get them to sin, get them to fall away. In the garden, I can't imagine what the devil's thinking, right? But he's probably rubbing his hands together. It worked so well. I deceived them, and now they've sinned. And now they're cast out of the garden. My plan is working perfectly. And then Jesus comes along and mucks everything up for the devil. Just like this angel, the satraps had no ability to control this. Daniel didn't have any ability to control this. You and I don't have any ability to control this. It is God and Jesus and that plan that steps in and saves the day. Because God does not want to kill you. God does not want to punish you. God is grieved to his very core that we would violate his law. And so he has set up a way that even though we have, of course the analogy is not perfect, right? Because Daniel didn't. Even though we have violated the law, we might be saved anyway. And it requires us to be, in a certain sense, blameless like Daniel. To accept the forgiveness and mercy that Jesus has offered at his terms, which requires some things that we do, and that's understandable. It requires us to be blameless in a very similar way to Daniel, and that's the only way we get to be saved. And it is the action of Jesus, it is in the action of Jesus, that the necessity of justice and the desire for mercy both find completion. It is such an amazing thing that even though the devil really tried hard, he failed. Judgment is coming, and you have a chance at redemption if you'll take it.